you were away all night. That sometimes happens in a police raid. You look exhausted. Of course I'm exhausted. I've just spent the night in jail. And you're supposed to be in New Jersey by now. Don't you have some lecture or something tomorrow? Some professor requiring your presence? He blinks. Exhibits a sort of disheveled aspect altogether. Collar loose and tie undone. Hair spiking madly into his forehead. Waistcoat all unbuttoned. A fine few lines have grown in around the corners of his eyes, pointing out the reckless black throb of the pupils. My God! Lectures? Who gives a damn about college? Why, your parents, I'll bet, for one thing. My parents? Yes, those. The ones picking up the check for the whole racket, if I'm not mistaken. Ginger, darling, how can you possibly think I'd leave you to rot in some stinking jail while I slink back to college like some damn little rat and listen to some damn little professor, as if that matters, next to you? Of course it matters. I'm just some dame you know in the city, you silly boy. I can take care of myself. You shouldn't have to. You wouldn't if you would just allow me. Billy. I stroke his cheeks a little, the way you might stroke a Labrador puppy to calm him down. How I worship those cheeks. He's got the loveliest bones up there, high and sturdy and dusted with pink on most occasions, as now. Hasn't got much beard to speak of, shaves but once a day. And the skin's as tender as any velvet, curving deliciously downward to his jaw and his plump raspberry mouth, presently pursed with worry. The room is cold and he's so warm, scintillating with distress. How awfully touching, you sweet dear thing. But you have a future, remember? A nice, bright, shining future, and futures like yours require a college education. I don't want any kind of future that doesn't have you in it, Jen. That's the kind of shining future for me. Oh, Billy, go home, sweetie. Go home and get some sleep. It's too late to go home. He kisses me again, more softly, hands sliding down my shoulders to the small of my back, voice running lower like an engine changing gears. Hudson Ferry's been in port for hours, and I don't want to sleep. I mean, uptown, your parents' place. They'll ask too many questions if I turn up now, 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'll wake up the baby. You know, for such a tender sprout, you're awfully persuasive, Billy boy. My uncle's a lawyer, remember? Is he a good one? Billy laughs into the hollow behind my ear. Not really. What about you? Do you want to be a lawyer? I don't care what I am, Jen, darling. Not right now. I'm just so glad to see you. Glad you're safe and free. Let's not go down to that club anymore, all right? Let's find a place somewhere, place of our own. Now, Billy. Oh, I mean it this time. You don't know what it's like, riding that stinking ferry back to New Jersey, knowing what kind of stew I'm leaving you in. I can't stand it any longer. He's unbuttoning my dress by now, nimble long aristocratic fingers, touching the base of my spine in the way that makes me shiver and forget things. Wherever you like, Jen. Upstate or down south or Timbuktu. We can get married and raise a bunch of kids. Says who? Says me. And what are we gonna live on, Billy boy? Moonshine? I'll find something. The dress is history. He picks me up and sort of crashes backward down on the bed. The mattress heaves and settles, releases the musty lavender smell of old sheets. Dear Billy boy, bones like a sapling, sweet lips kissing the scents right out of my skin. The night unwinds and spills around us. The snowflakes hurl against the window. I've got no more fight in me. I kick off my shoes and loop my arms around his safe, warm neck and say, "All right, whatever you like, sweetie pie, take me away." And he does. 13. A word about the few square feet of bedroom I call home. I'm sure you've heard about those nice, respectable, wallpapered boarding houses for professional young ladies. The ones uptown, where anxious matrons keep watch over fragile female reputations, and gentlemen callers are to be kept strictly downstairs. This isn't one of those boarding houses, I'm afraid. Although the landlady does her best, she really does. Mealtimes regular and nourishing, visiting hours established if not enforced. Sheets changed once a week and possibly even washed during that interval, though certainly not ironed. But the hard truth is, you can't attract the same kind of boarder on Christopher Street as you can on, say, East 69th Street. And a boarding house is only as respectable as the boarders it contains, wouldn't you say? I suppose the speakeasy next door doesn't exactly elevate the tone either. Anyway, to preserve appearances, Billy always climbs up the fire escape and enters through a window I keep unlatched. Nothing to steal, after all. And he tips Mrs. Washington $1 a visit because he's a gentleman. I believe he enjoys the adventure. He certainly doesn't enjoy the furniture. Have you ever tried to entertain a lover on a single bed? Foster's intimacy. I'll say that. 14. I mention all this because I don't want you to misunderstand when I describe how, upon waking later that morning, I find myself enjoined in a lover's knot of Baroque configuration, pinned to the sheets by Billy Marshall's heavy right thigh across the two of mine, my mouth encompassed by his shoulder, our limbs snarled together, his damp lips dangle along my ear, and his hair shadows my eyes in a kind of brilliantine curtain. The tempo of his respiration suggests utmost satisfaction, as well it should. The tempo of mine suggests, well, otherwise. I heave Billy's body aside and sit straight up, gasping for air, gasping for freedom. The air's dark but not black, and the illumination behind the thin calico curtain warns of a snow-streaked dawn. Next to my hip, Billy continues an exquisite slumber, embracing my shingle of a pillow. The familiar dimensions settle around me. Walls, window, chair, washstand, bureau. Not much space between them. I reach for my kimono from the hook on the wall and slither over Billy's corpse to stand on the cold floor. It's bare. I have a horror of dirt. We did not take long to express our physical longing, Billy and I, in the pit of a New York winter's night. Short and brisk and effective. My nerves still coarse from the aftermath, and when I peered my watch, laid out on the bureau in a perfect vertical line next to Billy's silk top hat, I discover there's a good reason for that. I have slept only 2 hours. Dear Miss Atkins at Sterling Bates will expect me at my typewriter at 9 o'clock, mind sharp and finger swift. I cast another gaze at Billy, white skin glowing in the gray sunrise, mouth parted and smiling at the corner. I wrap myself in the kimono and lift the extra blanket from the foot of the bed. If I'm lucky, I'll wake again before Billy does, so he doesn't catch me in the old paisley armchair, all by myself. 15. But when my eyes open again, the bed contains no Billy. No strewn clothes, no shining silk top hat perched on the bureau, no handmade leather shoes tumbled on the floor. No sign of life whatsoever. 16. He's left a note. He's a gentleman, after all. I won't quote it here. It's too intimate. To summarize, he had hoped, after such a night between us, after such a declaration on his part, after such kisses and so on and so forth, you get the general idea. And I have disappointed him. I have kept my soul to myself while taking all of his. He is going back to New Jersey and wishes my future happiness with all his heart. Billy likes to feel things, you see. He likes to feel them deeply. To experience life at its absolute rippingest. To italicize every thought and emotion that rises inside him. After some consideration, That is to say, gnashing of teeth and rending of hair and scribbling of yet more midnight letters. He'll be back for more. And I'll snatch him in my arms and whisper my thanks to the Lord. In the meantime, I'm due at the corner of Wall and Broad in 20 minutes. I expect you're disappointed. A typing pool. You figured I was employed in some more extravagant capacity, didn't you? Something glamorous and immoral. And it's true, I do have a small but picturesque sideline in the immoral. Immorality pays so much better, about which more later. But my mama's example rusts before me as a cautionary tale, and since Sterling Bates had the goodness to hire me 2 years ago, as a pink-coated college dropout with 8 nimble fingers and a pair of opposable thumbs, I find I can't quite let poor Miss Atkins down. So many girls let her down. Anyway, who can resist the allure of a regular paycheck? My room contains no closet, properly speaking. I keep my dresses and suits on the hooks on the wall, neatly pressed, and my shirts folded in order in the second drawer of the bureau. Stockings and girdles and brassieres up top. I wash myself with the water from the pitcher and apply my navy suit, my white shirt, my dark stockings, and sensible shoes. My small, neat hat over my shining hair. No cosmetics, not even a smear of lip rouge. Company orders. Banks. They're awfully conservative. Downstairs, Mrs. Washington has laid out breakfast. Some of the other girls are there, Betty and Jane and Betty the Second, drinking coffee and spooning porridge. Nobody speaks. The newspaper hasn't been touched. The room contains its usual atmosphere of Java and drugstore perfume. I pour myself a cup of coffee and spread a layer of jam over a slice of cold toasted bread. Pick up the paper and take in the headlines. Izzy and Moe led a raid the other night. Fancy join up on 52nd Street. 86 arrested, including 41 ladies. The paper drops the term ladies with conspicuous irony. No mention of doings on Christopher Street, but I suppose Special Agent Anson charged in and ordered his milk well after deadline for the early morning edition. Anyway, I haven't got time to read past page 1. I stuff the crust in my mouth, gulp the last of the coffee, blow a goodbye kiss in the direction of my sisters. I'm getting the silent treatment these days because of Billy, and I can't say I blame them. And as I whirl around the corner, thrusting arms and coat sleeves, fingers and mittens, I run smack into Mrs. Washington herself, wiping her hands on an apron. "Oh, Miss Kelly, there you are at last." "Mrs. Washington, can't stop, late for work. But, Miss Kelly, I'll be back at 6. Telegram." Halt. Hand on doorknob. Skin prickling beneath muffler. Mouth going dry. I think, that door surely does want painting, doesn't it? "Telegram?" I repeat. "Arrived last night. Put it under your door. Didn't you see? Western Union." "When?" "Oh, about 8 o'clock or so. I hope it's not bad." Well, I brush right past Mrs. Washington's hopes and on up the stairs. First flight, second flight, third flight. Panting, fumbling for latch key in pocket. There it is. Jiggle, jiggle. Door squeaks open. Floor's bare, of course. I would have noticed a damned yellow Western Union envelope on my nice clean floor, wouldn't I? Even enrobed by lovey-dovey. So Billy must have picked it up for me and put it somewhere. Forgotten to mention that fact in the heat of things. Dear Billy boy. Never would open the envelope and peek inside because he's a gentleman. The snow's turned to sleet, clicking hurriedly against the window glass. The room's in perfect order, every last meager object occupying its ordained place. Where would Billy put a Western Union envelope not intended for his own eyes? The bureau. But no splash of yellow interrupts the nice clean surface of my battered third-hand bureau. Just the mirror and the hairbrush and the vanity tray. Washstand is likewise pristine. Heart goes thump-thump, pushing aside my ribs. Hand clenches mittens. "Where the devil, Billy? Where the devil did you put that telegram?" Darlin' love struck Billy, consumed by worry, all of 20 years old and not thinking straight. Books lined up in rigid order on the wall shelf, bed all made, flat as a mill pond. Above my head, someone thumps across the attic floor and slams a door shut, and the furniture rattles gently. Rattles, gently. Thump, thump, thump goes my neighbor down the stairs, around the corner of the landing, down the next flat. The washball clinks its porcelain clink, the way it does in the pit of a New York winter's night, when you are expressing your carnal need for another human being, no matter how regardful you are of the walls and furniture and sleeping borders. I sink to my hands and knees, and there it is, wedged upright between the wall and the bureau. A thin yellow envelope. Yank bureau away from the wall a couple inches, stick arm in a gap. Miss Geneva Kelly, 11 Christopher Street, New York City. And I am correct about Billy Marshall's principles, the glue's undisturbed. For the smallest instant I just sit there, back against the wall, legs splayed, envelope pinched between my fingers, black ink staring back. My name, the large Roman capitals, Western Union Telegram, as if I didn't know. But no little black stars. Nobody's dead. That's something, isn't it? I stick my index finger in the crease and rip. 1924, Jan 31, p.m. 6:41. Miss Geneva Kelly, 11 Christopher Street, New York City. Mama sick. Stop. Asking for you. Stop. Come home earliest. Stop. Love, Johnny.
New York City, 1998. Ella always hated how, when you went to a cocktail party in Manhattan, or met someone over drinks, or dinner, or brunch with friends, the first question was always, "So what do you do?" Meaning, your job. She understood why, of course. New York was the city of dreams. It was where you went to chase those dreams if you wanted them badly enough. In New York, of all places, your career defined you. People understood you on the basis of what you did for a living. If your dream was money, you worked on Wall Street. Ella had yet to meet any investment banker who pursued his career because of a single-minded childhood desire to help companies meet their capital needs. If your dream was also money, but you weren't so good with numbers, you worked for a law firm. If your dream was money and you were okay at numbers, but were only willing to work 80 hours a week instead of 100, you went into management consulting. If your dream was, well, come to think of it, Ella had yet to meet anyone in New York whose dream wasn't money. But they were there. She saw them in restaurants and at Starbucks and on street corners. The actors and singers and writers and dancers and musicians and models, whose dreams were also money, but in service to some other, more complicated dream. As for Ella, she wasn't sure why she came to New York, really. She always dreaded that question, "What do you do?" because the answer was so boring. "I'm an accountant." Cue the eyes shifting around the room, seeking an opportunity elsewhere. The dull, automatic, as she explained that she was actually a forensic accountant, parachuting from dead company to dead company, dissecting the carcass to figure out what had gone wrong and who was to blame. Which was kind of like solving a complicated murder mystery, except with numbers. But by then, her new acquaintance wasn't really listening. The word accountant turned a switch in people's brains so that anything else you said just made a garbled blah, 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 blah in the air like Charlie Brown's teacher. Whatever. Why did Ella come to New York? She came to New York because she got a job offer after college from a large Manhattan accounting firm with health insurance and a 401k and a starting salary generous enough to afford her very own tiny walk-up apartment on the Upper West Side, close to the park. Not too many crack vials on the stairs outside, and most importantly, no roommate to ask her how her day went and eat all her leftover ziti in the fridge. End of story. End of dream. Of course, once she met Patrick, she thought she knew what had brought her to Manhattan. Fate. She was fated to meet Patrick there, fated to fall in love with him. She'd been so close to taking a job with that firm in Boston, and really, Boston was a better fit for her, felt more like home to her. And she hadn't. So she was meant to be a New Yorker, meant to be Patrick's wife. Her dream was love. Thank God, then, she had a backup dream. Her job. Sure, she'd veered off the partner track long ago, once she realized that making partner basically meant spending all your time trying to win new business and manage client expectations. But she liked what she did. In the first place, every few months, she got assigned to a new carcass. And if Tolstoy had been a forensic accountant, he would have said that thriving companies were all alike, but each company failed in its own way. Usually because somebody was doing something illegal. This was especially true in the financial services industry, in which Ella had ended up specializing, partly because she worked from the New York office, and partly because she ended up knowing Wall Street so intimately. The inevitable result of marrying someone who worked there. So many scoundrels, so much greedy ingenuity. That was the second reason she liked her job. Matching wits against all those greedy, scoundrelly minds. So she looked forward to being called into a partner's office at the start of a new gig. You never knew where you might get sent. Or why. Today, in particular, she'd been on the beach for 4 weeks now, waiting for a new assignment, doing routine internal business, PowerPoint slides for business pitches, interviewing college students, that kind of thing, that left far too much of her intellect free to wallow in the forensic analysis of her failed marriage. She preferred numbers. So orderly. So incapable of deceit. She stared at the family photo on the credenza behind Travis's desk. Kind of artsy, black and white, silver Tiffany frame, smiling wife and clean-cut twin boys of maybe 5 or 6 years, wearing white polo shirts and chinos, and wondered, for the first time, if Travis had ever cheated on them. Until 3 weeks ago, she would have said no. Of course not. Travis was a solid, decent guy. Not the cheating type at all. Never made a pass at her. Never treated the PAs with anything other than professional courtesy. Profoundly boring middle-aged haircut. But then, 3 weeks ago, she would have said the same thing about Patrick. Earnest. Romantic. Loved his mom. They'd been trying for a baby for almost a year. A baby Patrick really wanted. And then...
Get in a taxi now?
I'm sorry. Lost my train of thought. Taxi where?
Is everything okay, Ella?
Sure. Fine. Just need another cup of coffee, I think. Travis stared at her and spoke slowly. Patiently, like he probably spoke to his twins when they weren't paying attention. That was the kind of guy he was. Never lost his cool. Just like Patrick.
To Wall Street, Ella. Corner of Broad. You'll be working right at the bank's headquarters this time.
Oh, right. Ella knew better than to ask which bank. Instead, she glanced down at the spiral-bound briefing book on her lap, which lay unopened. Navy blue cover, flat over an inch-thick stack of white paper, held shut by two remarkably tensile, white-rimmed thumbs. The title seared her eyeballs. Sterling Bates Incorporated, Municipal Bond Department.
Ella? Everything okay?
Fine.
There's no issue here, is there? Conflict of interest? Because this is a sensitive project, like I said. Some big names involved. And the whole thing could blow up on us depending on what we find, which is why we want you on the team. We need our best people, and we need them at their best. We can't afford a single mistake on this. Got to have your head in the game. Are we clear here?
Ella laid her left hand flat on the surface of the briefing book, obscuring the cut-out white rectangle of black block text. Absolutely clear, she said. Ella's cell phone vibrated at 11:45, while she lay flat on the folding table in the laundry room, listening to the sounds from the other side of the wall. She picked up the phone and looked at the caller ID, set it down again. The table buzzed beneath her back at soothing, regular intervals before lapsing back into stillness. Immediately after it stopped, Ella felt the familiar twinge of guilt. Imagined Patrick flipping his own phone closed, staring despondently at the reclaimed wood floor in the living room or the tight, golden sisal weave in the bedroom. Or, just as easily, the industrial carpet in his 29th floor office at Sterling Bates. He called every day, sometimes twice. He also emailed, not as frequently. Most of those messages sat unopened in her inbox, but not all. Last week, the morning after she met Hector and Jen and came down to the laundry room in the middle of the night, she had such a terrible insomnia hangover at work, she actually forgot she was separated from her husband, forgot what had happened the last time she saw him and clicked on his name. Automatic response. Started reading before she could help herself. I am so sorry. I'll keep saying it over and over until you believe me. If you could just see what a wreck I am right now. I know I have a problem. I'm getting help now. I just want to see you and try to explain and apologize. I swear to God, it will never, ever happen again. I love you. I love our marriage. You are the most important thing in my world. Please. She'd clicked away to a spreadsheet, looked down at her keyboard and tried to breathe, sipped some coffee while her heartbeat rippled her silk blouse and her head ached and her stomach swam. Do not reply, she told herself. Do not reply. She'd sent back the flower deliveries that arrived daily at Aunt Viv's apartment, each one more fragrant and costly than the last. She filed the cards and notes in the circular. She'd let her cell phone vibrate into voicemail. She'd restrained her mouse from clicking on any one of the emails until now. She hadn't even told him her new address. She knew better. There wasn't an argument Patrick couldn't win, a deal he couldn't close. All he needed was a foot in the door. The phone buzzed again. This time, she turned it off entirely and concentrated instead on the music drifting through the walls, a jazz tune of exuberant syncopation in which a trumpet and a bass and a clarinet chased each other in dizzying circles, making her think, God knew why, of forest animals. That was it, scurrying up and down trees. This was real jazz, not the junk they played in tourist traps. Sound, bluesy, inventive jazz. And the patrons knew it. They laughed and chattered and danced. Hector was right. The vibration of heels sometimes rattled the floor, and while Ella couldn't distinguish any particular voice, she was starting to feel like she knew them, these people, communing by night in a Greenwich Village basement, hiding from the rest of the world, experiencing this elemental music in the shared marrow of their bones. The first night, she had listened for maybe an hour, standing the whole time, not moving a muscle for fear she might lose what she heard, like the sound would dissolve if she reached out to touch it, or even to approach the gray cinder block wall that separated her from them. She caught a glimpse of herself in the mirror above the table, and the sight of her own mesmerization startled her, eyes soft and lips round. If the image were of anyone else, she'd have said it was the look of someone in love. When she turned at last and climbed the stairs, 5 long pre-war flights back to her apartment, she went to bed and fell right asleep to the pensive, delicate notes of a piano. And she knew that she hadn't chosen this apartment after all. The apartment had chosen her. The music next door was already having its effect. Her brain settled into a comfortable trance. She wasn't ready for sleep yet, but she was close. The images shifting in and out of focus behind her eyes, the scenes and ideas, they weren't the frightful thoughts about Patrick and other women, about her vast, unfamiliar future, about the once sturdy milestones now scattered about that future like bowling pins, but about other things. People she didn't know. A champagne bottle tottering on a sofa next to a man's black tuxedo leg. Another man playing a nimble clarinet. Except he's not a stranger. He's someone you know, and you're trying to tell him something. Now, driving a narrow, tree-bordered highway while a sunset burns behind you. Somehow, Ella knew that Manhattan lay between her and that sunset, though she couldn't say why. Sitting down for a drink at a bar where you know the bartender, you're commiserating about something. The colors are so beautiful. A rich, red-streaked mahogany. Gold something. The taste of salt. "Time to go to bed now, Ella. You've had your fill, jazz and conversation." She lifted her head and rose to her elbows, groggy, jostling the cell phone so that it crashed to the floor. She leaned over the edge of the table and reached to the floor, but the phone lay just beyond the tips of her fingers. And for some reason, she didn't want to get down from the table altogether, which was the logical solution, but to snag the phone from her current position and... while she was attempting this awkward maneuver, some woman next door started to scream bloody murder. The music broke up. Ella, startled, fell right off the table to the gray linoleum floor. For several seconds, she didn't do anything, just listened in shock to the sound of that screaming woman, the long, excruciating rip of vocal cords, the bang of furniture turning over. Or was that a gunshot? A man shouted something terse, and the screaming stopped. Ella rose on her hands and knees. Her heartbeat crashed in her ears. Her arms shook. Somewhere in her chest, a gash opened up as if someone had taken a knife and sliced right down the center of her sternum. She braced her hands on the table and staggered to her feet. Spots broke out before her eyes, and she realized she wasn't breathing, that her terror and the downright physical pain assaulting her had frozen her ribcage. "Breathe," she whispered, forced her lungs to act. The cavity inside to expand, painfully, and contract. On the other side of the wall, silence had fallen. Not a sound, not a note. She thought, "I have to call the police." She picked up her phone, which was blank and dark, and pressed the power button. The light came on. She flipped it open. No bars. No bars when there had been 3 or 4 a moment ago. Go upstairs, she thought. Go see if anyone needs help. She turned around, still clutching her phone, waiting for it to find a signal, and ran for the laundry room door. Up the dark staircase, around the corner, down the dim hallway to the front door. She flung the door open and ran down the steps to the wet sidewalk. The drizzle fell softly on her hair and nose and hands. The smell of rotting garbage lay in the air, though the sanitation pickup had come yesterday and the pavement was clear. She wrapped her fingers around the railing that surrounded the basement next door. Not a sound. Not a light. Not a single sign that anyone lived there, let alone ran an exclusive jazz club into the small morning hours. Hello? She called. Anyone there? No reply. Ella became conscious of all the windows stacked up around her, the curious New York eyes behind them. On the other side of the street, a pair of men walked briskly, heads bent under the drizzle. Probably glancing her way and thinking she was some kind of crazy, some kind of Looney Tune out this late in her bathrobe and slippers. Maybe locked herself out, maybe tossed out by her jealous boyfriend. A taxi turned the corner of Bedford and crawled down the street, between the rows of parked cars. She tried again, a little more loudly. Does someone need help? Can I call the police? Ella knew she was dancing along a fine, narrow line. 7 or 8 million people crammed into one city with any number of wackos and crackheads. You had to look out for each other. On the other hand, you also had to know when to mind your own business and walk on. Walk on. Let people take care of their own. Let the secrets stay secret. The hidden stay hidden. Lest you find your own business ripped open and exposed to the world. The taxi's headlights flashed by. The street lay quiet around her. She turned away from the railing and went back up the steps. And that was when she realized that the two strangers were right about one thing. She'd run straight out of the building without her key.
"Can I make you a cup of coffee or something?"
Hector asked as they climbed the stairs. Ella opened her mouth to decline. "Sure," she heard herself say. "I mean, no, it's so late."
"No worries."
"I'm sorry if I woke you up, buzzing you like that."
"Like I said, no worries, I wasn't asleep."
It was such a stupid thing to do. Hector stopped, forcing her to turn around on the narrow stairs and look at him.
"Ella, has anyone ever told you that you apologize too much? It's no big deal. Everyone gets locked out sometime. You buzz your neighbor lets you in, it's the code. Okay?"
"Okay."
"Now," he said,
prodding her in the small of her back.
"You get on up there. I'm going to make coffee. You can join me or not."
She resumed climbing.
"Okay." "Okay, you'll join me?"
"No point wasting good coffee."
"I also have a bottle of good Kentucky bourbon, if that works better for you."
"Do I look like I could use a shot of bourbon?" He chuckled behind her.
"Ella, you don't take a shot of bourbon. You drink it from a glass, nice and slow, with or without ice. You take your time and savor it."
"Oh, sure."
"And yes, by the way, you do look like you could use a glass of bourbon. Didn't I warn you about going down to that laundry room at night?"
"Yes."
"And did you listen?"
"Obviously not." They'd reached the last landing, on the 5th floor. Ella hadn't been up this far. She'd glanced over her shoulder just before she fit the key in her lock. Just out of curiosity, of course, and not because she was hoping for a glimpse of Hector leaving his apartment. Hector entering his apartment. Beautiful Hector taking a pizza delivery in his boxer shorts. But she'd never climbed that last flight of stairs. Nothing up there but Hector's pad. He didn't even have a letter after his apartment number. It was just apartment 5 on the list of buttons in the vestibule. His door lay at the end of a short hall where the stairwell met the wall. He slipped past her and reached inside his pocket. A furious scratching started up on the other side of the door, like something was trying to dig a hole.
"Do you have a dog?"
Ella asked.
"That would be Nellie. Vicious attack animal. Watch out."
Hector opened the door, and a brown and white blur shot through the crack and hurled itself into his legs, licking and whimpering, making small delighted yaps like the bark of a seal.
"Nellie! Nellie, babe, there you are. Who's a good girl? Whoa, take it easy, babe. Only been away 5 minutes, you big numbskull. Down, Nellie. Mind your manners. Look, we got a guest."
The dog turned. A King Charles Spaniel, Ella saw, and unleashed another fusillade on Ella's knees.
"Get down, Nellie. Jeez, I'm sorry. It's like she loves everybody. Hope you're a dog person."
Ella bent down and stroked Nellie's long ears, like a pair of brown corn silk tassels, angled her face so that the desperate kisses landed just to the left of her mouth instead of square on the lips. "I totally am a dog person," she said.
"Nellie? As in Nell Gwyn?" "Very good, Sherlock. You're the only one who's picked that up."
"I love history. Kind of funny, actually. My full name's Eleanor, too. How old is she?"
4.
He crouched down next to Ella and put his hand on the spaniel's wriggling back.
"She was my mom's dog. We got her a puppy to cheer her up before her final round of chemo."
"So you're a very special dog, aren't you, Nellie?" Ella watched her twist about and return to Hector, calmer now, snuggling her nose into the corner of his elbow.
"Very special."
He straightened and pushed the door fully open.
"After you." "Yeah, you too, Nellie. Come on, don't give me the puppy eyes, babe. We both know you already had your walk." "Shoo, in you go. Show Ella inside. Attagirl."
The first thing Ella noticed inside Hector's apartment was the piano. A full-size grand Steinway that stood before the row of 3 windows overlooking the street. The lid was closed, and a thick plaid blanket covered the entirety of the case. A brass instrument lay on the lid's edge. Ella stepped closer and saw it was a trumpet.
"Wow," she said. "You're a musician."
"Guilty. Hope it doesn't bother you. I try to keep it muted late at night, but luckily the other residents actually like hearing my stuff for some strange reason."
Ella turned. Hector was already in the kitchen area, opening a cabinet door while Nellie circled his feet. He was wearing a short-sleeved gray t-shirt and sweatpants, his dark hair strewn carelessly back from his face, looking like a canine early in the era of domestication.
"Wait, is that you, playing at night?"
"Damn. Is it bothering you?"
"No, not at all. You're amazing. I thought it was, well, coming from downstairs."
Hector set down a bottle, half full of amber liquid and a bag of coffee.
"What'll it be, Ella? Uppers or downers?"
She crossed her arms.
"So, I have to confess something. I've never drunk bourbon before."
"No kidding."
"No kidding."
"Then I kind of think you should give it a try. Not that I'm pushing you in any one direction. You probably have to go to work in a few hours, right?"
"True. But I'm really, really not looking forward to it. So..."
"So, bourbon?"
"What the hell?"
"Attagirl."
He unscrewed the lid and walked toward her.
"First, you have to smell it."
"Like wine?"
"Nah, nothing so snobby as that."
He stopped before her and tilted the neck of the bottle in her direction. The room was lit by a pair of antique wall sconces, probably original, to the building, if not to the room itself, and the glow turned his olive skin an even deeper shade of gold. The two lights appeared as small white dots in his pupils. Just breathe it in, for your own enjoyment. Preview of coming attractions. She leaned forward and sniffed delicately at the opening.
Holy cow! How strong is that?
80 proof, I guess. But it's the flavor you're going for. Bourbon has this distinctive smell, made mostly from corn mash instead of rye or barley, like your typical scotch malt.
It's kind of spicy? Warm?
Hector tilted the bottle back toward his own nose, right where hers had been, and breathed deep.
Almost as good as drinking it. Ice or no ice?
Which do you recommend?
I like it without. Room temperature. You really get the flavor that way, but if you like your drinks cold...
He walked back to the corner of the room that formed the kitchen and pulled two lowball glasses from an open shelf. It was a funny kind of kitchen, neither modern nor traditional. Simple wooden surfaces and shelves, unadorned cabinets. Almost homemade looking, except everything fit together in perfect lines. A single pendant lamp hung from the ceiling, which must have been at least 9 or 10 feet high.
No, Ella said slowly. I think I'll try it warm.
Awesome. Hang tight.
He crouched a few inches as he poured, staring carefully at the bourbon as it streamed into each glass. The pendant cast a pair of sharp, thick shadows under his cheekbones, which were maybe a little too high and wide, now that she thought about it, throwing his face out of the fine proportion required for textbook beauty. But Ella admired them anyway. In a completely non-sexual way, of course. Hector straightened, set down the bottle, and lifted a glass in each hand.
Ready?
Ella moved closer to the counter and reached over to take her glass from Hector's fingers.
Ready as I'll ever be. Cheers.
Cheers. Now, hold on there, Silver. Sip slow. Just a taste to start. You won't like it at first. You have to give it time. Kind of like getting acquainted with someone complicated.
Ella set her lips on the edge of the glass and brought the bourbon forward until it touched the tip of her tongue.
That's right,
Hector said, watching her closely.
What do you think?
It's great.
Liar.
She laughed and tried again.
Okay, it's like being hit by a club.
That's more like it.
Hector took a drink and turned around to lean back against the counter, palming the glass and swishing the liquid gently along the sides.
Nice kitchen, by the way.
You like it. I actually put it in myself.
No way.
Way?
You're a carpenter?
I'm a musician, Ella. Actually a composer, which is even worse. So I had to find another trade to keep me solvent, right? Didn't want to sponge off my parents all my life.
You know what? I don't think I've ever met a carpenter in New York. Not one who lives in Manhattan, anyway.
I made a deal with the landlord when I took the place. I do all the carpentry-type fix-it stuff around here, and I get a deal on the rent. So, what do you think? Feeling better now?
Much.
You were pretty freaked out there for a minute.
Yes, Hector. I was pretty freaked out by the screaming woman in the basement next door.
Fair enough. But it's all good now, right? We went back down, didn't hear anything. If someone was really in trouble, you'd be hearing something. Trust me. Plus, Nellie would go nuts, right? Dogs are sensitive to all that stuff. Smarter than we are.
I guess so.
That's why the other tenants don't mind me playing at night, he said. Drowns out anything from downstairs.
Like screaming?
He shrugged. Some weird shit goes down sometimes.
I don't understand. Why don't the police get involved?
Who knows? Maybe the owner has an arrangement. Look, it's New York, right? We cater to every taste in this town. As long as it's consensual, you can have your lech as long as I have mine.
I don't know. That screaming didn't sound consensual to me.
Hector shrugged. Look, my bedroom window overlooks the back. If I see anyone bleeding or hiding a body, I'll call the police. Is it getting any better? The bourbon?
Ella looked down at her glass, which was less full than she thought it would be. Actually, it kind of is. Like drinking fire, but in a good way.
She pushed off from the counter and wandered back to the piano. Nellie, who had settled into an alert, silken pile at Hector's feet, leapt up to follow. Her claws scrabbled like jacks on the wooden floor.
You like music, then?
Hector called after her.
Love music. My grandmother's a cellist. She taught me how to play the piano first, then she let me play her instrument.
No kidding. You can play the cello.
Played it all the way through college. But I was never going to be as good as her. I mean, I loved it. I was a passionate player, you know? I just couldn't get my fingers to move like hers.
You want to jam a little?
Jam? Right now?
Sure.
Hector moved past her and set his glass on the piano lid.
No cello, but I've got a string bass you can try.
You mean, like, jazz?
If you like. Jazz, whatever. I can do pretty much anything.
He flipped open the keyboard cover and stood there, washed by the yellow street lamp outside, bare arms lean and poised, head turned a little to one side. His fingers started to run along the keys, awakening a ripple of delicate sound that went straight to Ella's belly. He nodded to the corner.
Bass is over there.
Ella took a deep breath and swallowed down the rest of the bourbon. Her throat burned. Her brain gasped for air.
How about some Beethoven? She said.
An hour and another couple of glasses of bourbon later, they were sitting side by side on the piano bench, thigh by thigh, playing Gershwin. Laughing. Ella had discarded her bathrobe, and her bare arm moved next to his bare arm, muscles plucking in rhythm. Nellie lay curled under the bench, snoring softly in the rests between measures.
See, the thing about Gershwin, which I love, Hector said, is that he isn't one or the other. He's deep. So deep. I mean, the notes are, like, revolutionary. But he's talking about you and me. He isn't afraid to connect at an emotional level.
He's not trying to show off to the Academy, Ella agreed. He writes for his audience. He wants to move you.
He gets you right here.
Hector makes a quick fist and presses it to his chest, almost without missing a note.
Lyrical, but complicated and unexpected, right? And it's so effortless, you don't realize how genius it is until you take it apart.
Ella made a last arpeggio and lifted her hands away.
I once acted in a school production of Porgy and Bess, believe it or not.
No kidding. Who did you play?
Bess. We only had one African-American girl in my class, and she hated singing. It was kind of weird, but it worked.
Awesome.
He closed his eyes and flowed into summertime.
You must have lived in some serious white bread suburb.
Yeah. Grew up in Arlington. My dad's a lawyer.
And your mom?
Law professor. And she models, believe it or not. Just for fun, and I guess to keep her ego stroked. Not that it needs stroking. She's like this glamorous 50-something who looks good in everything.
I love your mom. My girlfriend's a model.
Ella, in the act of swallowing the very last drop of bourbon, started to cough.
Wow. Nice.
Hector laughed.
It's not like that. What do I look like, some kind of smarmy modelizer? Hanging out in clubs?
I don't know. Maybe.
Nah, I don't have the bank for it. They're expensive, those girls. Also, kind of young. No, she's a hand model, actually.
A hand model?
You know, like Nivea advertisements. Gloves and jewelry. Especially jewelry. She's in that Tiffany engagement ring ad on the subway right now.
Wait, I've seen those. The big solitaire? She's pulling a ribbon.
That's the one.
Seriously, those are her hands?
Wild, huh? She had like a 6 a.m. call for that one. So she doesn't stay over often. I wouldn't get any work done. I mean, Ella, if you would get your mind out of the gutter,
he bumped his gray jersey shoulder against hers,
that she has to be in bed at 10 o'clock with her oven mitts on, and that's exactly when my brain starts making music.
Oh, that's a pain.
Yeah, I don't think we thought that one through very well. What about you? What's your story?
He shifted abruptly into something else, kind of jaunty. Ella didn't recognize the tune.
What twist of fate brought you here to 11 Christopher?
Oh, you know,
Ella stared at her bare, ringless fingers. Just needed a new place to live, that's all.
Look, I should really get going. I do need to be at work tomorrow morning.
Oh, yeah? Doing what?
I'm an accountant, she said, and this time remembered to add quickly, a forensic accountant.
Forensics, huh? You get to find out where all the dead bodies are buried?
Pretty much. And where they hid the money first.
Well, that is some seriously cool shit. You're like Sherlock Holmes.
I keep a pipe and a deer stalker in my desk drawer.
Don't forget the opium.
Cheaper than therapy, I always say.
He chuckled and moved into another tune, gentle and tickling, which Ella didn't recognize.
So, do you like what you do?
Most of the time. She paused. Actually, it kind of sucks right now. I just got assigned to the same company as my ex, so I kept expecting to see him in the lobby or the elevator.
Man, stressful. Big company?
Pretty big. Luckily, it's not his department or anything. I'll just deal.
Be strong, like you are.
The words took a strange shape inside her ears. Ella had never thought of herself as particularly strong. Her mother was strong. Her sister was strong. Her father had a quiet, unshakable strength that awed her. But Ella, she only felt strong from the inside of a piece of music. Or a spreadsheet.
Yeah. Wish me luck.
She rose from the piano bench and manufactured a gigantic stretch.
Thanks for the bourbon.
Hector rose too, in the middle of a measure, and closed the keyboard. The sudden absence of music made the room grow huge, made the space between the furniture yawn, made the air turn thick.
Nerves all settled?
He asked, looking at her seriously, like a doctor. His breath smelled of bourbon. She held up her hand, palm down.
Do you see me shaking?
Cool as a cucumber, Sherlock. Good news. Off you go, then. Get your beauty sleep.
He held his arm to the side.
Want a bottle of water or something to take down with you?
No, I'm good.
The room swam a little around her.
Actually, maybe the water's a good idea.
Hector went to the fridge while she threw on her bathrobe and went to the door. He handed her the bottle of water and asked if she wanted him to walk her down.
Thanks, she said, but I'm fine.
I know you are. You are as fine as they come. I mean that.
Thanks. I guess it's good night, then.
Good night, Ella. And if you need anything, just let me know, okay? If there's any weird stuff downstairs, I'm the house doctor.
The...